Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking about a tragic event that everybody will recall. And when I say it, maybe tragic is the wrong word, so I won't explain it. But myself and Martin are here. It was actually only a couple of hours ago, Martin, we told everybody we were taking a few weeks off.
Yeah, that lasted.
That it did. We got to 7 o'clock in the evening, and the reason we did that is because our friend journalist in Sweden, Philip O'Connor, has put together a piece, Philip, that we're going to cover and we're going to put out on this podcast. If you listen to this, you're going to hear this next. But this is, Philip, you might want to explain to the listeners what it is. We're going to say the name Anders Breivik, but if you just can explain what you've put together and why we're covering it now.
Well, basically, Tony, this time 10 years ago, we didn't know the name of Anders Behring Breivik. And all I can say is, if only things have stayed that way. On the 22nd of July, 2011, Breivik exploded a bomb in Oslo, in the center of Oslo, like smack bang in the middle of downtown, outside the Prime Minister's office in what they call Regjeringskvarteret. Okay, so this is the few blocks in the center of Oslo, where there's a lot of ministries in that. From there, he drove about 40 kilometers to the northwest of the city, and he went to Utøya, which is where the Norwegian Labour Party, Arbeiderpartiet, the youth wing, were having their annual summer camp. Now, you know, people will know the story. He got on a ferry. He went over to the island. 69 people were murdered that day. 67 of them shot dead. Many of them shot twice. And I've covered this story since that moment. You know, so I got off on the 22nd of July in 2011. I was just off a plane when I got word that this attack was underway. That was just, the bomb had just exploded in Oslo. And because I do the work I do, I was asked, can you get ready to go to Oslo? And I did. I went home. My passport was still in my bag. I made sure everything was there. Now, as it happened, I didn't go to Oslo then, but I stayed in Stockholm producing video and writing scripts for TV and that kind of thing. And it's just a story I've worked on ever since. I was in Oslo to cover Breivik's trial, but I've also covered the last decade. And the last decade has been fascinating in Norwegian politics. It's been fascinating the way, you know, what has happened in the wake of Breivik. And, you know, what he, at the time, he would have been seen as something of an extremist. And now his politics are basically, you know, the politics of Donald Trump, the politics of Viktor Orban, the politics of Boris Johnson to a certain extent. So, you know, when Jens Stoltenberg, the Prime Minister at the time, said he wanted more openness, more democracy, what he actually got was more Anders Behring Breivik. Now, in the intervening 10 years, I've been to Trondheim, I've been to Bergen, I've been to Stavanger, I've been all over Norway talking to people who lost people in this attack, talking to people who survived the attack. I've talked to people in the Arbeiderpartiet, in the Labour Party there, who are still active, who were elected off the back of it, you know, who spent time in government. And it's just, to me, it's one of those things that I can't forget. And it's like a little bit like the Auschwitz Museum that loves having a go at Matty McGrath. It's just one of those things that we can't forget. We need to remember what it was that happened there. We need to remember the forces that were behind it. And I was speaking to one of the survivors, Vegard, over the weekend. Vegard Venesland was, he actually grew up in Dunleary there, between the age of about 5 and 8. His father was a Norwegian diplomat, but he was probably in his mid-20s when he went over there, a bit old for the youth wing of the party. But I spoke to him yesterday about, you know, what happened that day and also what happened in the intervening years. And, you know, he was sort of asking me, or, you know, what I left the conversation with was that the discussion that we had and the discussion that the survivors are trying to have deserves a bigger audience, the biggest audience possible. And that's why I reached out to yourself and to Martin, to the Tortoise Shack, to Echo Chamber, you know, because I just feel that this is something that needs to be, not because it's something I've done, it's because these people have trusted me to tell their story and I want as many people to hear it as possible. Because at times it's a very positive thing, at times it's very uplifting, the sense of solidarity they show, but it's also fucking horrific. And I don't think that we can be involved in anything, in journalism, in media, in politics, without knowing where these things are coming from and where they lead to.
I just watched the movie. There's a sort of a movie on it, Philip, and I watched it. It's only a couple of weeks ago I watched it. I was left with questions after the movie. Was he part of a bigger movement? I know a lot of people who would have supported him before he went out or would have voiced the same opinions that they backed away from very quickly. But it seems to be that has gotten a grip in politics over there. Is that the case?
Yeah, well, you know, to be honest, Martin, the day I got the call to say that this had happened, right, and the immediate thing in all media was that this was an act of Islamic terror. The bomb was an act of Islamic terror downtown Oslo. And I was thinking to myself, not so fucking fast there, because, you know, I've been following this for over 20 years now. I've been writing about this and I've been talking about this. And I've seen these things happen. I know the people that Breivik looked up to. There's a blogger called Fjordman who was eventually unveiled. His real identity came out. He's been around for years talking about these things, right? And, you know, Breivik Breivik is very much a disciple of Fjordman, and this anti-Islamic, Islamophobic thing that he was going on with. You know, the difference between him and Fjordman was that Fjordman stuck to writing on the internet, whereas Breivik bought a farm, made a bomb, and armed himself. You know, so this was not a surprise to me. This was not, there was nothing new in what he did. But what was fascinating, Martin, was that Jens Stoltenberg, the Norwegian Prime Minister, was really like, you know, the country's father in how he led the nation through the grief. And as I mentioned, he said that, you know, he talked about more democracy and more openness being what was needed to deal with that situation. Now, the next general election happened in 2013, and Jens Stoltenberg was shown the door. And the party, or the coalition that replaced him, featured Fremskrittspartiet, the Norwegian Progress Party, of whom Breivik had been a member, right? So the Norwegian people weren't, you know, so overly affected, despite the scale of this fucking catastrophe. And I mean, I know you two guys know how, like, how many people I know in Norway. I've worked with their, both of their national soccer teams. I'm over and back there reasonably regularly in non-COVID times. As I say, I've been all over the country. I've talked to people all over there. There's not a single person I've ever met in the last 10 years who didn't know somebody who was killed or who had a family who lost somebody. That everybody in Norway was touched by this. And yet, somehow, they still managed to vote in this far-right party. And we talk about, you know, alt-right. No, far-right party. They've wound up in government after this. And these are the questions I think that Vegard is trying to answer and that I'm trying to answer, that the other survivors are trying to answer. How did it come to this? And one of the things that he brings up is they actually call it, in politics over there, the Udaya card. Right. So if a survivor starts to speak about Breivik and starts to speak about extremism, they're accused of playing the Udaya card, as if somehow they're trying to get an advantage, like that they need to bring up this tragedy to win every debate. You know, like, it really is, what is happening there is deeply, deeply ugly and sinister. You know, the fact that, you know, you can't, you know, respect the dead, you can't have a sort of a discourse with, you know, this thing, this can't be used. This isn't a stick to beat anybody with, when that's exactly what it should be, really.
Well, Philip, I suppose that the most important thing is people are going to listen to this now, and hopefully they will take, but the other thing I will say, for, to your credit, because you're not, it is something, and you are someone I spoke to before, and we've spoken about the process of radicalization and how it's taken hold, and how, you know, the discourse, the dialogue, the lexicon, it's all adapted, it permeates, and it does seem, 10 years on, that a lot of these views, unfortunately, now are not just taking grip, but they're actually popular to the point where they're also profitable, you know?
You know, it's not just that the far right parties are saying them and are given a platform to say them. The regular conservative parties are now saying the same things that Breivik wrote in his 1,000-page manifesto, which I read the night of the attacks. An awful lot of it was copied and pasted from elsewhere. You know, that was one of the tasks that I was given. And this is regular conservative stuff here. You'll find this on the fringes of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. You'll find it on the moderate party here in Sweden. You'll find it in Norwegian politics and Danish politics. And not only that, the Social Democrats, the Labour parties in this part of the world, in order to sort of scramble to get back voters, have also shifted to the right. So you have things like being said by Danish Social Democrats now that, you know, Olaf Palme must be doing somersaults in his grave, you know? And that's why, Tony, it's so important. You know, when we talk about this process of radicalization, when we talk about the oxygen of amplification, when we talk about all these things, that we realize what's going on. Now, you and I and Martin have been saying these things for many years, and people just don't believe us, you know, despite the fact that everything we have said, you know, is based on fact, it's based on research, it's based on, you know, academic research. And yet the same mistakes still get made. You still see, and I hate to pick somebody out, but you still see the programs that Claire Byrne presents making the same mistakes over and over again. I believe Justin Barrett of the National Party, who are a National Socialist Party, was given a platform just because, you know, he was able to get a fraction of the votes in Dublin South West before the recent by-election, you know. And if we're not capable of learning from that, because the petri dish that Breivik sprang out of was this dark corner of the internet that wasn't really accessible to everybody at that point. But not only is it accessible to us now, it's all over our newspapers and it's all over our radio and it's all over our televisions. And we need to know, we need to call things by their proper names, lads, because if we don't, this is just going to take over again. And we're in the middle of it now.
And we're soft to it in that we've had it for years. It's not something new. We've always had fairly right-wing columnists in our Sunday newspapers espousing right-wing rhetoric. So we're softened up to it. We don't
can I say, Martin, I want you to, because we wrap this up very quick, I want people to listen to it, but I will. There's someone made a comment recently where, and this is not to pick on the individual, but someone who said that they thought Muslims in Ireland, mainstream personality said Muslims should go to intern camps, is now advertising fairy washing up liquid or something on the telly, you know. So when you think of that sort of transition between these things, and we saw, you know, someone also within one of the fashion shows, or God love me, a celebrity news show that I'm not that familiar with, but apparently was removed from Instagram because vaccine putting forward, how do we put this, spreading false information about vaccine efficacy and stuff. These are mainstream individuals as well. So yeah, sorry, Mark.
Yeah, it's just that we are softened up to it, so we're less aware of what's coming at us, Philip. I think that's the problem.
I think a lot of it has to do with literacy. A lot of it has to do with understanding. But in the conversation that people are about to hear, lads, Vegard, like, because let's remember, he's a politician. You know, he went into politics, he stood for election and was elected in 2013, which is a great thing for the party to have, right? But he was also part of the groupthink that led, you know, Norwegian politics in its entirety to shift to the right. And at one point of the conversation, I talked to him about solidarity, because essentially that is the vaccine for this far-right nonsense that's going on at the moment, is solidarity, right? Their thing, their virus is fear. And our vaccine is solidarity. And it's, solidarity can be expressed in so many ways. Sometimes it's like standing with trans people, or it's standing with people who are in direct provision, right? But it's also in standing, like, you know, gents like you and me and Tony, who've grown up in the same city in somewhat similar circumstances, all of a certain age, right? It's solidarity in that. It's solidarity in knowing that we don't know everything, but being prepared to listen to people and being prepared to give them a platform. And I think that's what we need to do, rather than speak too much. And I think in the conversation people are about to hear, Vegard only mentions the name of the terrorist once. And that's a lot of people who survive that don't mention Breivik's name at all, because they don't want to talk about him. They want to talk about other things. They want to talk about other victims, and they want to talk about where we go from here. And that, to me, is the conversation that we need to be having.
Philip O'Connor, I think we will leave it there and let listeners listen to this piece. I know, we can't recommend it more highly than that, though. Insofar as we were taking 2 weeks off until half an hour ago, and now we're not. So, Philip O'Connor, thank you so much for sharing this with us. And I hope the listeners will actually listen, share, and recommend it to other people. Oh, and Philip, they can find you at Our Man in Stockholm. And they can get you on, this will be on SoundCloud as well, and get you on Twitter at Philip O'Connor. You'll be also doing some sports journalism again for a little while. So we'll probably be picking your brains over the Olympics as things pick up in that, you know. Thanks so much for your time.
And thank you, lads.
On the 22nd of July 2011, at 15:25 Central European Time, Anders Behring Breivik detonated a bomb in the centre of Oslo, killing 8 people.
That horrific story still unfolding out of Oslo, Norway, the city where they hand out the Nobel Peace Prize, under siege today in 2 deadly attacks playing out one after the other.
From there he drove approximately 40 kilometres before getting a ferry to the island of Utøya, where the youth wing of Arbeiderpartiet, the Norwegian Labour Party, were holding a summer camp.
That horrific assault came as a car bomb outside a government building shattered downtown Oslo, the Norwegian capital, killing at least 7 more.
At just after 20 past 5 in the evening, Breivik opened fire shortly after stepping off the ferry. Over the next hour and a half, he killed 69 people, mostly young, mostly with gunshots, and injured 110 people, 55 of them seriously.
I saw that a police officer came out of the woods, and I thought for a second that we were safe. But that's when I saw his rifle, and that he pointed it at the kids who still was at the shore. The kids that was too afraid to swim. And then he executed them while they were begging for their lives.
He used hollow point bullets designed to inflict maximum damage. Many were wounded first and then shot in the head.
We are in Norway tonight, and it is a nation in shock. A country that is known around the world for its peaceful ways is now reeling from terror.
Tonight, police say they have a suspect in custody, the man they believe to be responsible for both attacks.
On August 24th, 2012, Breivik was found guilty and sane by a panel of 5 judges and sentenced to 21 years in prison, which can be repeatedly extended by 5 years if he is still considered a threat to society. Vegard Grøsli Venlesland survived the attack on Utøya. And to mark the 10th anniversary of the worst attack on Norwegian soil since the Second World War, I asked him to talk to me about that day and the 10 years since. This is his story.
The island is situated about an hour's drive, not even that, outside of Oslo, in a fjord. It belongs to the AUF, the Labour Youth Movement, donated by the trade unions way back. And it's kind of it's their island, and they have camps there, the summer camps, and they'll have meetings, seminars, and things like that. And they use it as a venue for meetings and stuff like that. They have done that for ages, and then of course, as I'm sure we'll talk about, there was the scene of the terror attacks 10 years ago. But after it was rebuilt again, it's now in use again as a gathering place for the labor youth, but also any other youth movement that would want to have their summer camp or other seminars there.
When did you first visit the island? What was the first event that you were at there?
Yeah, so I started in AUF. God, when was that? That's it was through fellow students when I got into youth politics. So I was probably around 25 or something, I want to say, which was pretty that's pretty late for a youth movement in Norway. A member of the Labour Youth would be more like 16. but there was pretty active local chapter at the university I went to in Oslo, and so we got engaged. I got engaged around in my mid 20s or something.
It is one of those things that's odd about Scandinavia, because politics seems to me to be an awful lot closer to people's everyday lives than maybe it might be in Britain or in Germany or in places like this. What was it that attracted you to Labour and to the Labour youth movement in Norway?
Yeah, so I studied the Middle Eastern studies at the university in Oslo, and also a bit in the Middle East. So I international politics was my drive in my early 20s. So so when I was looking at getting engaged into actual party politics, it was international politics, and specifically the Middle East question that I was interested in. So I found the Labour Party and the Social Democrats kind of had an approach to that question where, you could acknowledge that there's an occupation and the Palestinian right to self-determination, and kind of mediate that very troubled ground, so international politics was my main drive to get into politics. But then once you get engaged and you go to meetings and you meet other fellow social democrats, you kind of get interested in all aspects of politics, right? And most politics certainly isn't international. It's the other way around, right? All politics is local. So as I kind of got more and more engaged in politics, the international part kind of faded a bit away, I'd like to say, because most people are interested in their school, their health services, when the buses, if the buses are arriving often enough, and stuff like that. So as I was getting more and more engaged, and certainly when I was back in 2011, I was getting more into national politics. Right. And then it's the classical social democratic values, right? Making more equal society, making those who are less well off, giving them the same opportunities as those who are well off, and redistributing wealth and a lot of these things, which we know from social democratic parties and the left, basically, around Europe.
Tell me about that day. The attack happened in the afternoon. Do you remember, what building you stayed in? As far as I remember, there was probably about 500 or 600 people on the island. What did people do there on a normal day when they're at the summer camp?
Yeah, so I mean, so summer camps are definitely best when the weather is good, and which it was like on the Wednesday and Thursday. And then that Friday came and it was just pouring down. Like the tents were like flooded, and it was really bad weather. And early in the day, we had like one of the really like main events was that the former Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland, who, you know, used to head the WHO and she's a pretty like prominent figure. She was going to visit the camp for the first time in like 10 years. So everyone was super excited. And so that was like really a main event. It was just packed inside in the main building and listening to her, and really like a good atmosphere despite the rain. And then of course at around 3:30 the bomb goes off in downtown Oslo. The terrorist blows up like, you know, almost a ton of I think it was like 950 kilograms of explosives outside the Prime Minister's office. And even back then, the rumors were spreading fast on social media, you know. So, you know, we got wind of that. And then everyone was like really, really upset. And obviously, like being the, you know, wondering whether this was just like an accident or gas leak of some sort, or like an actual attack. And then if it was the latter, it would, you know, it would have scary for the labor youth, as you know, labor was in part in governments. So it was really like, I'd say, a tense atmosphere. And we had like an information meeting on the island, I think like a few hours later, where we gathered the people from like the participants from, especially from Oslo and the surrounding counties, just to have an information meeting and tell people, you know, what we knew. And it wasn't, by then we knew it was indeed an attack. And I remember specifically, like, they were saying, and we were all saying to each other, like, okay, this is really scary, but listen, we're on the labor youth summer camp on an island in the middle of a fjord, in the middle of, you know, nowhere. This is the safest place we can be. And, you know, when we were saying this, the terrorist was driving from downtown Oslo and towards our camp, loaded with guns and munitions. So, I mean, I don't think even like an hour after that meeting, the shooting starts on the island. So
he got a little boat. He loaded up the firearms that he had with him and he was brought over to the island. And he wasn't long on the island when he started to shoot people. Can you tell me when you realized what was going on? Did you hear the first gunshots? Did you realize what it was?
Yeah, so it's a small island, and so gunshots kind of like, for an untrained ear, sounds a bit like fireworks, right? So if anyone was shooting up fireworks on the island, you know, everyone would hear it. So yeah, you kind of hear the first shots. I was at it is an island, right? So he showed up in a police uniform with like bags and with the guns inside them. And he said, like, I'm from the police and I'm going to have an information meeting to you guys about the situation in Oslo. And like people trusted him. They didn't check the bags. And then he took them on the boat. He took the boat right over. And then when he comes on, there's like this, this woman on the island who's kind of like the manager of the island. She says, like, what's in the bags? And then he's forced to open the bags, and that's when the shooting starts. And she's like, she's actually the first person who's killed. So he kills two people down right by the boat, basically. And then he moves up towards the tent camp, which is where I was. I'd like to say, like, I was fortunate enough to see him actually kill people far enough away from me that I knew he wasn't a person to trust, because he did come in a police uniform, right? So if you're hearing shooting and you're seeing scared people and you see a cop, it's like, yeah, I'm gonna approach the cop, right? So, and I actually saw someone do that, like he moved towards him saying, lower the guns, people are scared. And he just waited till she was 2 meters in front of him and shot her twice in the head. And that's how he systematically went around the island. So for me, it was like seeing that, and you know, being fortunate enough, in air quotes, to see that he was not a good cop, not a cop at all, of course. But that was kind of, I think, life-saving for me, because then I just ran in the other direction, right? You don't really think, you just act. And it was like, and he turned his attention, guns towards me, and he shot, and it's like you can hear the bullets through the grass, you know, like in a war movie or something. It was, but you just keep running. And I hid in a building called the school building, I guess is a direct translation. We were like 40, 50 people hiding there. We just barricaded ourselves there, locked the doors, put mattresses in front of the windows, and just hid there for the entire duration of the attack. He actually came to the building. You know, I specifically remember saying this, what a building, that's a really stupid place to hide. You know, it's so easy to find on an island. It's better to like hide in the bushes or in the woods or something like that. But he found it, and then he tried to enter. The door was locked. He fired two shots through the window of the door, screaming, lots of screaming inside. And then he just left.
Did he say anything?
No. Didn't try to break in, didn't try to do anything, just fired through the windows, heard some screaming. I guess that might have scared him away. And then he left. And I, during the trial, I was like, and in, during his explanation of the attack, I was anxious to hear him like explain his thoughts on that specific episode. And he had no real recollection from it, right? He was just like, yeah, and then I was there, but the door was locked, fired a few times, but then I moved on. Because I think it's so rare, you know, like when you survive something like this, you always go through what you should have done and could have done different and stuff like that. I didn't get an answer whatsoever from the trial, what his thoughts were. Because people who did hide in the woods and did find, like, in my view, pretty good hiding places, they were found and killed, right? So in those situations, it's really like random and sort of luck that decides whether you make it through to the other end. Because, you know, we were youth, we weren't trained to do this. No one knows exactly what to do. You just act on an impulse.
Adrenaline. The attack went on for a very long time, Vega. This wasn't 5 minutes. It wasn't, you know, 10 minutes. This went on for over an hour, almost 90 minutes. And what goes through your mind when you're there with, you know, maybe 40 or 50 other people? Do you think you're a sitting duck? Do you think he's going to come back? Can you still hear the shooting outside? What did you talk about during that time?
So I was hiding in one of the rooms with one other person. And under a bed, and we were just like complete silence. Just that was it. And I sent a few text messages, you know, to my family, and basically saying, you know, I love you, and kind of like one of those last SMSs you'd send if it was your last moments. So what goes? I mean, you're just praying that he doesn't get in. And after he tried to enter, I was in the neighboring room from where the entrance door was. So I thought he was in, I thought for quite a considerable amount of time that he was actually still in the building, in the neighboring room, that he just was kind of hunkering down there and taking hostages. But once, because like the island's small, so you could hear shooting all the time. So kind of understood that like he's not around where we are, right? But I know you're just praying and hoping that he doesn't enter, and then trying to plan what to do if he does, like make yourself as small as possible, you know, be as quiet as you can. So if he does enter, he might not check underneath the bed and stuff like that. And he's actually arrested right by this building. So I don't really know what his plans were after that. But like, but I think in my case, the police got there in the nick of time. Of course, that was too late for many others. But in our case, the story of us in that building is kind of like one of the few places where people actually hid, a lot of people hid and made it. So if I dare say anything like positive about the whole attack, then 50 people actually surviving in that building and him not entering it, that was very lucky and positive, I'd have to say.
One of the things he did was when he was walking around the island, which is, as you say, is very small, you'd walk around it in a few minutes. He told people who were hiding in the bushes that it's okay, the police are here. And then when they came out of their hiding places, he killed them. He was arrested quite close to the building where you were. What did it take to get you out from under that bed, knowing that somebody had been around there shooting for the last 90 minutes? Did you trust the police when they arrived?
I have a pretty vivid memory of this, actually, because so when he approached the building the first time and shot through the door, I could hear the footsteps outside. He was just walking like any other person, like this pretty like distinct footsteps. It didn't have the sound of like a tactical kind of approach. But when the police came, I could hear the police, but I could hear several people, but you could barely hear them. Right? So they were like obviously moving in a more like a tactical manner. I'm not sure if that's the correct expression.
Stealthy sort of a way.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, I was in a neighboring room from where the entrance door goes into, so they stormed the door like SWAT style and just, you know, like, and then I heard people in the other room screaming, but I heard no gunshots. So when I heard that the police had broken through the door and I heard no gunshots, but I just heard police get, you know, down, get down on the ground and no firing, I felt like pretty safe that it was just the police. So then I went up from the bed and I just like screamed, we're two people in here. And the police, like, they're barging in with shields and the laser sighted guns. And, you know, you get the laser in your face and you're like, and, you know, it's probably finger on the trigger for those guys when they do that. So, you know, hands in the air and just like, and then screaming that, you know, good guy. So, a few subtle things and the major thing, obviously, that there was actually no shooting after they barged through the door. So, I still if I see like armed police officers, you know, I still have to like, you know, remind myself this, like sometimes police are armed and, you know, it's for a good reason and they're there to protect you. Because I did see an armed cop actually try to kill me, you know. So, you know, it's psychologically, that's actually something you have to kind of deal with afterwards.
Yeah, it's one of those things that police, unlike in Sweden and unlike in Denmark and other places, police aren't armed. They don't go around the place armed. I come from Ireland. They don't go around the place armed there either, but they have been at various points in the past. So it would be very unusual to see. I don't think I'd actually ever seen an armed policeman in Norway in the 10 years I've been going over and back before then. When you left that room, Vegard, obviously they want, you know, to get people off the island as soon as possible, but it's also a crime scene. There's also an awful lot of dead young people around. Can you remember what it was like as you left the room and then left the island? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so now that's true, but it wasn't true that they wanted to evacuate us early, because we were in a safe place. And there were two cops that were left at our location and they could guard 50 people, which I think the cops considered like a reasonably well spent resource, right? If two cops are guarding 50 people, then, you know, that's good. Because if there was actually several attackers on the island and you're walking 50 people on the tracks to evacuate them, then that's another bloodbath, right? Yeah. So we were actually among the last people evacuated from the island because we were kept in the building. And I also, and they took us to a boat, and they had by then moved the, like we were not taken through places where people were dead. And they must have, according to, you know, what I learned later, they must also have removed some dead bodies. But when we, so then we take the bus to the shore. And so we're like, you know, 50 and there were some other people, so say like 60 people on that boat, last people evacuated up from the island. And a lot of, remember, a lot of the people didn't really know what was happening, because not everyone had seen people be killed. So it was still like very insecure. What's actually going on? Have people been killed? Have they just been injured? Several, you know, people were thinking this. So when we approached the shore, there are like tens of bodies along the shore with the white sheets over them. And this is just like a sudden kind of, you know, scream through the whole boat. Then we realized we've lost several comrades, you know. And you arrive on the shore and there's like 50 ambulances, five ambulance helicopters. And I could see from the faces from the ambulance personnel that they were shocked from the faces of us, right? So they were, it was just like this empty look, I guess, on our face and with shock. And then these ambulance personnel, some of them quite young, you know, just like equally just shocked, very professional and everything, but just like trying to take in what had happened. And then, you know, being checked up. And I don't know, from then on, you know, you feel safe, you lower your guard and stuff. And then you start reflecting on what happened, and also like desperate for information on whether people, you know, you're close to are dead or are actually alive. So then we're brought to like this hotel nearby where they've set up like a center for survivors and for loved ones who can come to see if their kids are actually alive or not. And that's when you start meeting people, you know. You know, how's it last forever? You know, because they're alive and you're sorry. So yeah, very emotional, I'd say, few hours.
There were families who came to that hotel and to other hotels around there, and you know, only to find out that their children hadn't made it. When did you meet your loved ones again? Did people come looking for you? Did you ever get a response to those SMSs that you sent from that room?
Yeah, but eventually I did. Yeah, absolutely. And but I also turned off my cell because I was afraid that like sounds from it would reveal our position. So I also was afraid of my reaction of the replies. Like I didn't want to make noise and start crying from replies. So I just turned off my. I sent the text I need to and turn off my phone. And then I actually hitched a ride with a friend of mine back to Oslo that night, so I could meet family and my girlfriend and my brother. My brother, by the way, who narrowly survived the bomb explosion in downtown Oslo. So, I mean, he passed just like a minute before it went off. So, yeah, I was able to like meet up with my family then that same night. So, I mean, just a huge relief. And then the news out of there was still like, you know, 10 people dead or something, which I knew was just at the time, it's just like, no way, there's just 10 people. Yeah. And then, of course, the next morning we had the real number, yeah. 69 people killed, which, you know, I mean, it was a lot more than anyone, you know, had feared. So yeah.
What was it like going to bed that night, Vegard? I mean, were you exhausted? Were you able to go asleep? Were you Did you feel guilt because you made it and others didn't?
Nah, you don't sleep. I mean, adrenaline is just pumping too hard, and my phone had actually gone out of, like, went dead. Battery was flat, so I recharged and started answering text messages. And I was, at this time, I was the vice president of the Oslo branch of the Labour Party. So I kind of quite quickly went into that role. So then there was a lot of
politician mode.
Like a crisis mode, right? The organization is in crisis. You're one of you're part of the leadership. So you kind of have to step up and solve stuff, you know, make decisions and help people and do a lot of practical stuff. So it was like, you know, getting a place in Oslo where we could meet, making sure that police had the correct lists of the participants, answering like loads of press questions, and from, you know, national to international news outlets. And that's a very, like, it's a mode, right? And you get like very fixed on just solving what's in front of you. And it's very meaningful as well, right? Because you're actually like guiding the organization and the people in it in a direction. Obviously, you know, Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg and the president of the AUF, Eske Pedersen, were kind of front and center and doing a great job in national media. But us in the local chapters, in the Oslo branch, for example, there was a lot of practical issues that we had to solve. So I quite quickly spent a lot of time doing that, like basically all day, all night, because I wasn't sleeping anyway. So, but looking back at that now, although it was exhausting and I hardly slept for like probably a week or maybe even longer, it's like, it felt good to have meaningful stuff to do. And something that was connected to the attack, but also that was felt meaningful. So I think that helped me actually, looking back now, I think it helped me get through it as well as I did.
Am I right in saying that Håvard Vedahus, who was the president of your local chapter, was killed in the attack?
Yeah, he was. So, we didn't get in touch with him, and we were also like, you in these situations, you have to let the police actually do like formal confirmation of whether people are, you know, killed or alive. But we had people who had seen him dead, so we knew that, and we hadn't heard from him. So, you know, we were hoping for the best and planning for the worst. And we were two vice presidents, so we quickly found out that we have to, until we get the final confirmation from the police, we have to just lead the organization as best we can, the local branch as best we can. And then, yeah, I later took over as the president of the Oslo branch and stayed on for like past trial, I remember. And then it was time for me to kind of step back. But by that time, I was getting kind of old. So they were giving me shit for being too old, so which I completely deserved. So, but I think staying on for an extra year, kind of through the trial, I think you know, it felt meaningful for me, and maybe if there was any time a youth movement needed then a boring old man, then I guess it was
of like 29 years of age or something as you were.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, I look back at that now, 10 years, you know, I was young back then. Yeah. But in the labor youth sense, I was an old man.
Tell me a little bit about the trial, because I was in Oslo for parts of it. Did that bring you closure? What was it like to see Breivik going into the courthouse, doing his salutes, trying to take over, trying to use it, as he said he would, as a pulpit for the views that he held? How did that feel to you as someone who had been there and seen him do what he did?
Yeah, so I participated in as much of the trial, like as a spectator, as I felt I needed to kind of get closure for myself. Now that included his explanation. And also we had several members from AUF Oslo who were testifying. So I went to the trial when they were testifying. But I tried to kind of to keep it at an arm's length, though that was virtually impossible given the media coverage. But like I know people handled this a bit differently. Some people just needed to hear the whole trial through, and it was like it went on for weeks, you know. But I was one of those, like, I'll participate as much as I feel I need to, and then try to do other stuff to make kind of life go on. I think the trial kind of it showed that like justice prevailed. It gave him the opportunity to explain himself, but didn't turn into that much of a propaganda outlet for him as I think he had hoped to. I think also he didn't come through with a lot of like, he wasn't impressive in any way, right? During the trial. So I don't think, you know, he was successful in his mission to use the trial as kind of like his microphone for his message. His message came through as very thin and not founded in facts whatsoever. And I think the justice and the rule of law prevailed more in that trial than his ideas. And I think it's something that you kind of have to go through. Like I, for my sake, I'd want to like bury the dude, you know, tried to kill me, killed lots of my friends. But luckily in a well-functioning democratic society, you have other people than the victims who decide what happens to the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. It's a very core value of democratic society, at least in my opinion. So I'm glad that happened, and it was well done, and you know, it stands. It kind of closed the legal aspect of the whole case, yeah. And then we should have started dealing with the political one right afterwards, right? Yeah. But we've barely started doing that. So
that's the thing, because you stood for election, if I remember rightly, in 2013, and you were elected to the Norwegian parliament, but Jens Stoltenberg and the Labour Party lost, and they were replaced in government by a sort of a conservative coalition, which featured the party of which Breivik had been a member, Fremskrittspartiet. That to me was, I don't know if I've ever seen a greater slap in the face for the Labour movement than what the Norwegian electorate did in 2013. And since then, the sort of the normalization of what Breivik was saying and doing has now become in America and in Hungary and in Poland and in the UK. This is exactly what, these are the things that he was saying. How does that feel for you as a politician and as a survivor of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, he wasn't an outlier in any sense, not in his, not in the way he perpetrated the attack, not in his ideas, not in his ideology. He was the start of something that he was used as like influence from terrorists, right-wing terrorists who would come later, Brendan Tarrant in New Zealand. And they looked to our terrorist in Norway to get inspiration. So and even we had a right-wing terrorist attack in Norway in 2019, or was it? Yeah, 2019. A guy who killed his stepsister because she was adopted and you know, had a wrong color skin, and then tried to attack a mosque where he was stopped by two like retired elderlies. Yeah, it's been normalized. And like we're having this huge debate in Norway now. Finally, I'd have to say but because it's not like what happened was that we thought that like if you there's this like Norwegian saying if you it's like the trolls if a troll you know gets sunlight on them he bursts right mm. and it's with the extremists as it is with trolls so if we just bring the ideas up to the light and we put sunlight on it then it will just burst and go away but that's not what happened it got more mainstream and newspapers in Norway out of fear of like you know silencing this minority opinion of the right wing far right wing they gave them more room in newspapers and when the labor youth tried to say hey this is dangerous we need to talk about this FRP needs the far right party in Norway they need to address the issues with those in their party who you know agree with you know what should I say like the ideas of like this Muslim invasion of Europe and kind of a lot of that rhetoric that the terrorists have but that's also like huge online you know like and which kind of leads you into this the whole narrative is like there's an occupation coming you just can't see it right and it's Muslims are taking over Europe and well if there's an occupation we're occupied during the World War II right and when there was an occupation we had a resistance movement we killed them right and so when these people are saying and the Labour Party is in charge of this conspiracy of letting the Muslims come in and take over Europe well the resistance movement should then deal with the Labour Party, right? That's what Breivik, the terrorist in Norway, did. And you have people, even within political parties in Norway, who agree with this mindset, with this ideology. Yeah. And in my view, that should be disqualifying to be a member of the party because it's dangerous, right? We saw that 10 years ago in Norway. It's dangerous. And those views should be actively engaged with within the party in the public eye and should be something for the fringe parties, not for like populist parties. So I don't think the parties in the right in Norway have done not even close enough with cleaning shop. And you know, it's ironic because the only organization people who have like claimed that we need to have like a discussion and a final settling of this issue, the right wing, the ideology behind the attacks, it's been the labor youth. I was like, they're part of the left. The left doesn't have to have a reckoning with the far right. The right has to deal with the right of politics, right? So we on the left, we disagree with even the moderates on the right. So the right wing parties need to have that conversation, and they haven't. And quite recently, they had an op-ed in the major Norwegian newspaper, Aftenposten, where they had taken no, like where they, instead of, they say that when labor youth are trying to lift this topic up into debate and try to engage the right-wing parties in taking a stance, they're saying that the labor youth are attacking the voters of the Fremskrittspartiet, of the far right. And it's not what we're doing. It's members of parliament who are having these views from the Fremskrittspartiet. So I mean, it's complete, like, this. I mean, they haven't done anything to clean their shop. And that's, like, you can probably hear me now getting a bit engaged and almost angry. And, well, after 10 years and seeing that, like, too little, if anything, has been done, then, you know, I'm not angry. I'm furious that this hasn't happened. It's not much to ask for when, you know, a dude killed 69 youth at a summer camp and 8 people outside the government offices.
One of the things, though, Vegard, that I've noticed, certainly in Sweden and in Denmark, and you can tell me if this has happened in Norway as well, is that it's not just the conservative parties, the right-wing parties, who are moving towards Fremskrittspartiet, the Progress Party in Denmark, the Sweden Democrats here in Sweden. it's also the social democrats themselves, right? So what they have done in Denmark is appalling. What they're doing in Sweden is appalling. There's no longer permanent residency for refugees, for instance. Everything is, you know, there's a certain amount, but where everything is, you know, 5 years, 5 years, 5 years. So all of these protections that used to exist, and that is basically a sop to the far right. It's basically a sop to the people like Fremskrittspartiet and like the terrorists in Norway. So, like, how, like, what should the response of social democracy be? Because to me, you have to stand at that point where you stood on Utøya that day. It's not up to you to go to meet other people. Do you think that, and does social democracy, Arbeiderpartiet in Norway, do they agree? Or have they tried to go to meet Fremskrittspartiet halfway? Because it is working class people, you know, it's everybody, but it's working class people who are also giving these people votes now.
Yeah, absolutely. And So then it has to be like, I think the far right parties in Scandinavia are they're all far right, but they are very different. Also, like the Sweden Democrats are pretty, they have Nazi roots, right? So they're pretty extreme.
Yeah, they've told us who they are. Yeah.
Yeah. So and the Fremskrittspartiet in Norway is certainly different from that, right? I mean. When they were established, they were called like the how does this translate? But like the party for lower taxes and less. So they are a truer like right wing populist party. So lower taxes, you know, cheaper fuel, and you know, less immigrants, definitely. So it's a very good question, because you are absolutely right. In Denmark, they've moved closer to far right on immigration issues, but not on economic issues, for example. I feel like Labour Party is at least from our opponents, they like to label us as like that we've moved close to Fremskrittspartiet on immigration issues. I do think it's important, like the reason, your motivation for doing it and how you talk about it, which is very different from the Labour Party's perspective and the far right. But personally, like I'd like a more liberal immigration policy within the Labour Party as well here in Oslo, in Norway. So I wouldn't disagree with you, like on that, you know, move to some extent in that direction. I think people, like after the immigration wave in 2015 or when it was, like, I think people saw that like there has to be some sort of balance, and maybe that's what political parties also on the left are trying to figure out. But I'm not sure. It's a really good question, I guess. I work for a trade union, and we see a lot of the members in the union are, you know, they are kind of like you say, they do respond well to the very populist rhetoric from these parties, right? Because it is just like cheaper gas, less taxes, and less immigrants, and then, you know, check, 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 and then they go to vote. But it's more complicated than that, and it's never that easy. And I think Labour Party, although they haven't moved more to the right on that issue than I like, I think they managed to tread a decent line on the topic, and rhetoric is important, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of frightening. Like I say, I actually misspoke. In Denmark, they're not called the Progress Party, because that's what Fremskrittspartiet is when you translate it from Norwegian. They're called the Danish People's Party, Dansk Folkeparti. So I made a little mistake there, but that's cleared it up for the listeners. If I could just ask you a final question there, Vegard, just to get back to what you were saying there, I honestly believe that, you know, the way to talk to workers, the people in your trade union and trade unions all over Scandinavia, is again to push for solidarity, not what's in it for them, but what's in it for all of us, which is essentially the roots of the labor movement. But if we move away from that, how will you mark the 10th anniversary? How will you mark July 22nd this year? Will you just ignore it? Because I noticed you've used Breivik's name once in this conversation, but for the most part, it's not a name that you seem to use. How does it feel 10 years on?
Yes, it's really strange, because it's one of those, like, it feels like forever and then it feels like yesterday at the same time. I was a student living you know, sharing a flat with other students 10 years ago. And now I have a job, my own apartment and two kids. So that's like a very different life. So in that respect, like it's ages since, right? But approaching every anniversary, it really comes closer. And like, I had no problems recalling what happened that day, for example, like it was yesterday. And also indeed, like the days after, which were filled with a lot more, I mean, shock and disbelief and all that, but also a lot of nice expressions of solidarity throughout the society in Norway, and indeed like internationally, which was really moving and helped us get through it. So, but on this specific day, it's about being with family and friends. And I also enjoy being with the people that I was on the island with that day, and like people that are engaged in the labor youth. And now, since it's 10 years on, most of them have moved on to the Labour Party, or just we've all been through the same, right? So we all feel the same heavy. It's a really emotional and heavy time in the weeks before the 22nd of July, and then you have the anniversary, and you're attending some memorial services, and then the kind of weight lifts your shoulders and the day's over, kind of. That's how it feels for me, at least. So I'll participate in a few of the memorial services and hopefully just be with family and have a few beers, and maybe one or two too many at the end of the day, just to mark the end of the whole thing. I have started though, if I can make a selfless plug for my own idea here.
Of course.
Because, so I had the idea of creating a Twitter account, which is going to live tweet the whole terror attack. So we have a lot of information, and indeed, like even tweets from 10 years ago, which kind of gives you a raw, like, the impression of the attack while it was happening, right? So, you know, after the bomb goes off, you have like several tweets and news agencies being like, big explosion in Oslo, no one knows what happens. And the idea of this Twitter account is kind of like there are some like history accounts that do this, like what happened on this day during World War II, you know, 70 or 80 years ago or whatever. So we're going to live tweet us through the whole day, and we've started. So I think that's going to be a pretty heavy experience for the ones who follow the Twitter account. It's at Aldri Glemme, which means never forget in Norwegian. Live tweets, 22nd July. And for us, it's been like we're three people doing this, and for us, we want to take like the followers into a like minute to minute, if not like second to second account of how this went down. And of course, that's going to be extremely painful to follow. If you're following that Twitter account and you put on notifications, I think you're going to have a pretty solid impression from those minutes from Uta. You know, he's killing someone every minute. So we're going to take the followers through that. And one motivation for doing that is research shows that like most people have actually forgotten about, like they hardly, not forgotten, but they hardly or never think about the 22nd of July. It's like four or five people hardly or never think of it. And when you ask that question, break it down for people on their political affiliation, people on the right, it's like over 50%. So what happens is when people forget, they kind of play down the attacks in some sort. So when a survivor or AUF or Labour Party says, we need to talk about right-wing ideology, they've kind of said that we're using this card, Utøya-kortet, they call it. Like in, you have an ace, like an ace up your sleeve or something that you're pulling out to win a debate. And as someone who saw five or six people get shot in the head because they were and killed because they were active in the youth movement, that's pretty fucking provocative to hear someone claim that I'm using a card that I have up my sleeve to win a debate when I'm saying that the ideology the guy who killed those people had is dangerous and we need to fight it. So this Twitter account, I don't think you can follow it and take in those tweets during that day and not think that, like, shit, this was so horrible that no one who experienced this would ever use it to win a debate.
Argument, yeah.
They would use it to do something about the ideology behind it. And that's where we want to be in this day, like 10 years on. That's the conversation we need to have now.
Have you been back there since?
Several times, yeah.
How was that?
So, first time's mental wreck. Like, you're fearing that that everything will just, you know, come tumbling back in all the emotions, and that you'll feel that you're in danger again. But like, I mean, you've been to Oslo, and have you been to the island?
I've never been to the island, but I've been to the site where the bomb went off. Yeah,
yeah, and that looks like a war zone even still, you know, because they never fixed the buildings and took down the ones they were supposed to. So that still looks like a site, right? Now it's a construction site, but it's been cordoned off, and they spent ages on deciding what to do about it. But Utøya, that was just bullet holes, and they aren't as visible. So when you come back, and when I first came back, it was a sunny day. It was like, oh, this is, you know, oh, this is where I was. And I was like, really, it was emotional. But then you look around and it's a beautiful island. Like, so you're back there and you're just like, shit, this is, I've been there many times before the attack as well. And it's like, this is where we were discussing politics and debating how to fix the Middle East and solving, you know, different school issues regarding to school or welfare, or all these topics that we were discussing and debating on the island. And that felt like reassuring to me and kind of reduced the anxiety of going back. And now Labour Youth, AUF, got like huge donations from several different actors, and they've managed to build up a centre there for memorial, but also for like democracy. And so they have probably hundreds of school classes there every year now. Mm. Also internationally, people fly in to visit the site to learn about, you know, how do we secure the democratic society? How do we fight extremist sentiments in our society? And what how do we have a sound and good dialogue-based conversation about difficult topics? So you can go and do that at Utøya now, which is very good. It's a very good way of like moving forward, remembering the ones who were killed, but also continuing the fight for what they believed in. So it's become like it's always going to be for me a very emotional place to go, but now it's filled with a lot of hope as well, which is nice. I'm going back in a few days, so it'll be good to be back. I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, no, it's a good feeling.
Well, I look forward to maybe sometime I might come over to Oslo and you might take me there with you, because I so much appreciate you taking me through what happened to you on that day and what happened to you since. So every strength to you now on the 10th anniversary, and I look forward to following your tweets as well. Vegard, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me, and looking forward to taking you to the island.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was outside that courthouse in Oslo on an August day when Breivik was found guilty and sentenced for what he did. When we spoke to people afterwards, they said that they wanted closure, but many said that there could be no closure and there has been no closure. Instead of that being a turning point against the kind of politics that made Breivik believe that he was right to do what he did, they've become mainstream. People who think like Breivik are in parliaments all over the world, dragging us back to a place that few of us want to go to. Vegard and people like him have battled in Norway, as others have battled around the world, but it seems like these ideas have taken root and they're going to be very hard to get rid of. 10 years on from what happened on July 22nd, 2011, in Oslo and Utøya, and closure still seems very, very far away.